everybody. Welcome to episode 122 of the Alexi Sal podcast. The week of it's Thursday, the
16th of April
now. And things have paused slightly in the Gulf of hummus.
Right, yeah.
Which is, you know, where the world's, and that's being held up. Obviously, the Iranians are bombing the world. The so named because that is where all the world's supplies of hummus come from. And so Turkish mezze restaurants are running very low of hummus, and substitutes are being served, liver pate, porridge.
They're going to be started at the Waitrose riots.
Yes, people in Waitrose are
freaking out.
Rioting because they can't get the supplies of what they're going to do for their weekend dips, for their book groups and for their parties, because the Straits of Hormuz are completely blocked by the Iranians.
I did a shop at Morrison's the other day. How often do you do a Morrison's shop?
Used to have a very nice brand shop in Camden Town with vast amount of parking.
Ooh.
They closed it down, sold off all the land for housing, I think, and now there's a shitty one near just by the roundhouse where we're doing our... Ooh. Are we announcing that yet? No.
Oh, fuck it. We're going to do the roundhouse, 2nd of August, matinee, live show. We won't go all the way and announce the guest just yet.
Right.
We've got a very special guest.
All right. Anyway, that would be where we'd go for our... If supplies of hummus. So anyway, you went. What did you think about Morrison's?
I've been a few times and I'm always like pleasantly surprised. It's good. It's really nice. And, you know, it's not as expensive as your Sainsbury's or whatever.
No.
But
the
hummus was very good.
The hummus was very good.
The hummus
what would
was
be
really
your
nice.
List of supermarkets? Because I have to say, well, mine would probably be number one, Booths, which is a northern chain, of course.
Yeah.
And there's one near our relatives in Ormskirk, which I just think is fabulous.
It's so the Waitrose of the North, isn't it?
Yeah.
There's one.
And
in
then
Luxford,
my number two would be, I have to say, Waitrose, really, because my local one. Number three, I'd say that Asda we like.
Yeah, the old Kent Road Asda.
Yeah, the old Kent Road Asda and Asda in general.
We should get matching old Kent Road Asda tattoos.
Yeah.
You and me. Our cars, both of our cars. You're my Vauxhall, your
Citroën.
Citroën parked in the Asda petrol station.
I'm
with
still
these amazing
I'm still
with
running
the diesel
around.
Price and the petrol price.
I'm still running on the because I don't really go very far in my car. I'm still running around on diesel I bought before the tax on the Straits of Hummus.
This is how the war affects us.
Yeah.
I filled up my car and haven't touched it. I've just left it there in case I'm waiting for Armageddon when I have to flee to the countryside.
Yeah. It's not beyond the bounds of possibility. So I'd say Booth, so that's a bit of an affectation because obviously I only shop there like once a year. Waitrose, then Asda. And the German ones, I've got no, I always get Lidl and Aldi mixed up, really.
Mm.
So I'm not sure about them.
Lidl has kind of gone up its own arse and I think it's a bit hoity-toity now.
Is it?
Aldi is where it's at. That makes my top three.
All right, okay.
Aldi. Your list is quite bourgeois.
I know. Well, I'm not trying to hide that. You know, I can't. I'm not going to pretend. You know. Yeah.
Not bring your Aldi shopping bags. Bring your Costco shopping bags to Waitrose. But my bourgeois choice is Sainsbury's is in my top three just because it's my local.
Yeah.
But the just because if you got the, oh God, this turned into an advert, but if you got the Nectar card, it's outrageous. And they, all the supermarkets obviously have their own members club or whatever the card is they have, which just kind of gains you access to prices that your, makes your shop so much better.
Yeah.
But the Sainsbury's, yeah, the Nectar deals on Sainsbury's are, really, Linda, are what Linda keeps bringing me back, to be honest.
Really? Linda handles that.
But the fruit and veg, you'd expect it to be better, but it's not amazing. Aldi has amazing fruit and veg. Morrison's is top notch. And their deli, their nice homemade like cheeses and hummuses and olives is nice. It's climbing the ranks.
In the one in Camden Town, which is, they had this thing where they, it blew a kind of mist.
On the veggies, yeah.
Over the veggies. I'd never seen that before. And they took it out pretty quick. They obviously, the clientele reacted badly to it, which I thought really was a critique of the people at Camden Town.
That's weird.
Yeah.
Making their fingers pruny.
Yeah, but I thought it was just such a nice effect.
And the Morrison's, our local one in Camberwell, has its own butchers and fishmongers, which is just, it's so much better, isn't it, when you can, well.
Yeah, I'd go, I mean, I'd see, Sainsbury's would be my least favourite out of the five.
Really. It's the locality for me.
Yeah.
And I used to go with my dad every weekend to Sainsbury's growing up. So there's a bit of nostalgia in it for me. But it's wearing off. The locality really does it for me. You mentioned, because I brought up my Vauxhall, something weird happened. I got something in the post. Have you ever had this? I've got a 2007 Vauxhall Astra.
Yeah.
And I got a letter from Vauxhall in the post.
Product recall.
Yeah. And they're going to change the airbags because they're deadly, apparently.
Yeah.
I've never seen that.
I've never had a product. You think with Citroen, because they're pretty shonky, that you would have a product. I've never had a product recall, no. You're lucky, I guess.
I guess I'm lucky. But then they couldn't give me an appointment for like 3 months. I'm like, what? I'm driving in this death trap.
Yeah.
I can't find the letter right now, but it's all letterheaded with the red Vauxhall logo.
Yeah.
Really weird.
No, well, you know, yeah, congratulations, you're special.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I suppose well done to Vauxhall, now part of the Stellantis combine, for tracking you down, I guess.
Stellantis?
Yes, they're all part of Stellantis. Vauxhall, Opel, obviously, Fiat.
Renault.
No, Renault's not part of Stellantis.
Peugeot, Citroën.
Are they part? Oh, yes, Peugeot, Citroën are part of Stellantis, yeah.
Dodge. Oh my God, yeah, Chrysler?
Chrysler, yeah.
Wait, Stellantis owns all of these brands?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
What the hell? There is just like four companies in the world, isn't there?
Well, yeah, certainly motoring, there's a lot less than you think. The cars have different bodies, but they're all built on the same platforms now. So, your Vauxhall will be the same as a Peugeot or a Citroën or... It's the Alfa old motoring Romeo. Correspondent in me coming out.
Alfa Romeo Fiat.
Did anybody hear me on BH on Sunday morning? On
lots of people did.
Oh, right. Because I reheated some of the conversation we'd had on the podcast.
What's BH?
It's a program that runs between 9 and 10 on Radio 4 on a Sunday morning. It's generally hosted by Paddy O'Connell, but it wasn't. He was having a week off or something.
What does BH stand for?
Broadcasting House.
And that's also the name of the show?
Yes.
And, okay, how come you got invited?
I don't know. I used to do it regularly.
Is it just like a casual talking thing?
You review the papers. In the last 15 minutes, you review the papers.
Well, Helen messaged us on Instagram. Follow us at AlexiSalePod. Hi, I just wanted to say that I was listening to Alexi yesterday on Radio 4. I think The World This Weekend. Well, no, it was BH. Okay.
Yeah.
And it's the first time I've ever heard anyone on air articulate my views on the space mission. It was very encouraging to hear this and feel that my views might be shared by other people. Thank you also for quoting Whitey on the Moon, which I had not come across before. I find it baffling that more people don't share this point of view. it's good to have a counterpoint to the wall-to-wall space exploration obsession that the media has had over the latest mission. Thanks, Helen.
Well, I think there is much more anti-astronautism than it. It's just one of those positions you're supposed to. It's a given within our kind of media that everybody loves space travel, right? And sort of views that contradict that of a kind of, you know, a kind of not allowed, really.
And did you also talk on Palestine, Lebanon?
I didn't really. I didn't get a chance to. I did have a story. I mean, you actually get very little time. There's three of you. The other one was Peter Hitchens. Actually a right-wing Daily Mail columnist, but somebody who I often agree with, and a much better person than his dickhead brother, Christopher, late brother. And the other one was actually the daughter of a friend of mine, Anna Tuschinski. Actually, I didn't realize until afterwards, but daughter of the late Andrei Tuschinski. And so, but you don't really have enough time. I did have a Israel, you know, about, you know, Israel obliterating villages and all that. I did have a story lined up, but we never got to it really. So,
okay. Well, people seem pleased that you were on there.
Yeah.
And voicing, you know, the opinions of our side.
Yeah, no, it was interesting because last time I did, it was years ago. I mean, it was before the genocide, really. And I thought I was on some kind of blacklist, you know, because of, there's a nice researcher called Natasha who'd emailed me a few times about whether I wanted to come on. I hadn't been able to do it. And then, you know, finally I could do that date last Sunday. And so maybe they'll have me back a few more times.
Fingers crossed. Well done, comrade.
Oh, thank you.
Bringing the fight to the front lines. So even our supreme leader isn't afraid to lead the charge into battle.
Legacy media. Yeah, it was nice. You know, it was nice.
Our supermarket conversation reminded me of, I was talking to my landlord the other day. We were talking about the war. And him and his wife have been like prepping.
Right.
They've lined their windows with bomb film stuff, the plastic film that stops your glass from shattering into your living room. They've stocked up on all the cans and they have go bags in their cupboards. And I was shocked. And I was sitting there. I really wanted to like have fun with this premise and take the piss a little bit, but you know, it's my landlord and I was just in shock hearing this because it's such an alien concept. But then what do you think, Alexia? Are they smart? What do you think?
Not the blast protection really, but the stocking up. I remember me and Linda had a conversation years ago and I hadn't really thought it through about what we'd stock up on. So, Linda?
What?
What was it I was going to stock up on?
What?
Remember we had that conversation about what we... Was...
Dough.
Dough, yeah. was all it was tin tuna or kidney bit? Dough. Yeah, I thought I was going to stock
up. All right, Homer.
I was going to stock up on dough. I don't know. I hadn't thought it through really because you know, it's not. I thought dough being the sort of ground zero of bread, as it were, that somehow you could keep it forever and then bake loaves as and when you needed them.
Stock up on fucking flour.
Well, flour would, that would make more sense.
Dough goes off.
I hadn't thought it through. That's, I think it was tin kidney, I don't know, kidney beans and dough, I think was what I was planning to stock up on, yeah.
This
was just quite a few years ago. We were just having a conversation about, you know. But we have, we have quite a lot of stuff in the cupboards. I think I'd be living on, you know, stuff like hampers you get sent at Christmas and stuff. Well, I get sent anyway. You probably don't. So I'd be living on like Fortnum and Mason's date and ginger chutney. You'd be down to that by about week two. I think I'd probably get all anxious and eat everything right away. But yeah, I think it makes sense to, you know, have a stock up on comestibles.
I don't think it's, and there's any harm to it, is there?
No.
I just wish I had,
the space.
I'm in a tiny one bed. Yeah, I don't wish. If I had a larder, I'd have loads of tins in there, obviously, yeah.
Yeah.
And a big sack of flour and all that. But
I mean, if the balloon goes up, you should fill the bath and obviously every receptacle with water before the water goes off.
Oh.
Would be a tip there.
Yeah. Oh yeah, they also told me they put hydrogen peroxide in their water before drinking it.
Well, that doesn't sound like a good idea, but
I said, "Isn't that bleach?" And they said, "No, it's not bleach." I was like, "Okay," but it doesn't sound. There's too many. If something has an X in it, I'm not putting it in water, basically.
No.
There was apparently water issues in their area.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Especially the other thing is weaponry anyway. We haven't.
I wish I had the space. Yeah, if we're in America, you know, everyone gets, and you don't live in a big city. And even here, if you're in the countryside, land is a lot cheaper, isn't it? I'd love to have a fucking little house in the country and like have a shed full of guns and cans and go bags.
Okay.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, maybe we should build a little bunker in your patio.
Yeah. Right. No, I think I'm not letting you in.
Okay. That's that topic. Well done on BH.
Thank you.
Supermarket
booths, and that's an affected choice, but then it would be Waitrose. I'm not going to lie to you people. I mean, I'm honest. I'm going to say Waitrose because that is where I do most of my shopping. Waitrose, and then we got some good little, you know, I mean, they flourished during COVID, didn't they? The little corner stores, really. We've got some excellent ones on the Gray's Inn Road.
Yeah, good for your bits and bobs, of course.
Yeah. So, yeah, number two, general South Asian run convenience store. Waitrose. Did I say Waitrose?
You've said Waitrose a few times.
Asda. And then the Sainsbury's at the bottom is the bottom of my list. We had quite a funny conversation. I've been trying to actually get it. There's a big, near my mum's on Park Road, there's a gigantic 24-hour Tesco's. And I was thinking about this the other night. There was my mother towards the end of her life, obviously had incontinence issues. And I remember being in Waitrose about 1 a.m. or something in Park Road, buying like plastic bags and disinfectant. It looked very... It looked very suspicious, really. Mm. But the other thing was, I had a conversation with my friend Harry, my late friend Harry, and he said that Tesco's was actually built on the site of a big hospital in Liverpool, which I didn't know, in South Liverpool. And he said, my father died in that hospital. My father died in that Tesco's. Sort of interesting way to say it, really, you know. So, you know.
Jesus.
And somebody else who was with us said, I had a miscarriage in that Tesco. God.
Clean up on aisle.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I've never been able to make it work as a kind of idea, really, but there's something, you know, that the spirits of what used to be there and still inhabit the Tesco's, you know. I don't know. But, yeah.
You ever seen a dead body?
I have, yeah. Well, I saw my mother's dead body, but also I was on a number 30. Yeah, have I talked about this? Talked about someone. I was on number 30 years ago with the old Route Master, and I sort of saw a man in the sitting in the reflection of the glass. And I said to him, that man's dying. And he was having a heart attack, and there was a Jamaican nurse, and she got him on the long seat, at the back, four seats, was thumping his chest. The bus stopped. But he was clearly dead. And everybody just legged it off the bus. Didn't hang around. This poor man's wife was there.
Oh, God.
And then also once I remember we were, I think I was still with my parents, we were sailing out of Boulogne or Calais, and they were pulling the dead body out of the harbour there. I've seen a few dead bodies.
Yeah.
We watched them.
I just thought of it. I know you mentioned the dead, but yeah, I know. I thought of my first dead body. I was like six or seven, vague memory at the Brentford Leisure Centre. A vague memory of this blue figure just floating in the pool. My dad picking me up and taking me to the changing rooms, but I was obviously being carried by him, so I was looking over his shoulder.
Yeah.
And just saw the staff like fishing him out with the net on the long pole, getting his body over to the edge.
Somebody had a heart attack rather than drowned.
I guess. I don't know. He was blue.
Cyanotic, I think.
Yeah, it's always it's real life. It's the real life that we're all numb to,
Yeah, yeah.
Sorry for bringing that up. What were you going to say?
Yeah, that's a real... That's going to be a real downer of a podcast, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. No, we got those. We got that supermarket chat in there.
Yeah.
It's pretty upbeat.
Yeah. But does Peter Crouch still? I watched a fucking ad break the other week.
Yeah,
but all the fucking adverts in all of them featured Peter fucking Crouch. In every single one, he advertises fairy fucking. Washing shit, and then he also advertises some car. It was just all wall to wall Peter fucking Crouch.
Well, he retired from football quite young, didn't he? And he's done well for himself.
He's got a podcast, doesn't he? Is his podcast still popular with his wife?
I can only imagine so. I don't know. He's from my neighbourhood.
Is he?
In Ealing, yeah. My brother mugged him once. When they were teenagers.
You should be admitting that.
Ah, fuck it. They were teens. We were playing football in the park. I think my brother took his lunch money or something.
that's why he obsessively makes money now by polluting the ad breaks.
His sister went to my school and he would pick her up in his Ferrari or whatever.
Yeah.
Like this tiny car. And you could see his knees through the window.
Was she very tall as well?
She was taller than average, yeah.
Yeah.
And she looked like him with blonde hair.
Right.
But a nice, really nice girl. And he does all the gambling ads as well. And there's lots of gambling ads that are infuriating and just seem to be just wild evil. With about, just everywhere.
Yeah.
More than ever. And is there there's a story there? I don't know. But I heard that it's something to do with a government payoff or something. They've lowered restrictions on them or something. Do you know anything about this?
I don't know. I know that, Keir Starmer's election campaign, where he refused to reveal the donors until after he'd been elected the leader of the Labour Party, that the second biggest contributor was pro-Israel fanatics, people like Sir Trevor Chin. But the largest amounts were donated by gambling interests. So make of that what you will.
Well, yeah, but the Labour seems like, looking at the news, a Google search here, Labour seems to be wringing their hands about it, but not doing anything. They're saying should be restrictions.
Oh, absolutely, it's another tax on the poor, isn't it? You don't get Paddy Power shops in fucking Virginia Water High Street, or
no,
we get them in vape shops and bookies in poor people's areas. It's a plague on the ball. Yeah. It's really wrong.
All right, Richard in on Patreon asks, support the show, please. Go to patreon.com/ Alexis Ale podcast. That's patreon.com/ Alexis Ale podcast. Chuck us a couple of quid a month. You can join the chat groups there. You'll be, I'll see your questions first. And you get to watch the video episodes of this podcast. And Alexi reacts every week, which we're going to record as soon as we're done here.
Mm-hmm.
Where Alexi reacts to stuff he's done in the past. And they're really fun little video episodes. Richard asks in the chat, were Radical Posture an actual band?
Not really. There was a couple of friends of mine, Ali Bogdanos and Jim Bamber, who were in a band called Studio 2, I think they were called, who supported me on tour. And then they would back me.
For like
I would
Dr.
pretend
Martin's
that they
boot.
Were a Marxist, yeah, and Dr. Martin's boots on the young ones. Jim, and they're augmented by my dear late friend David Stafford.
Right.
So I used to pretend they were like a Marxist funk band or something like that, but they only existed really, you know, in my imagination, as it were. They never really existed outside stuff I did.
They must have had their own band, or they were session musicians.
Well, Jim and Harry were a band for a while. Yeah.
What's the gag there? Radical Posture. What am I missing?
It's a kind of. I don't know. Really, it's just a radical posture. I don't know. That was it. Okay. Really. That was the gag.
All right. Yeah.
I don't know. Seemed funny in the 80s.
Posing as radical.
Yeah.
He also asks, "Do you remember your split second appearance in the video of the Fun Boy Threes, The Telephone Always Rings? The Fun Boy Three?"
Yeah, I think.
The Telephone Always Rings?
I think that was one where I just got back from Australia and I had terrible jet lag, and they rang up and said, "Do you want to be in this video?" So I went, "Yeah, all right," and just sort of went round there and shot it. And then
they were your mates. How did they ring you up?
Hey,
they were your mates.
I can't remember who rang me up, but it was. Okay. I remember it being. I remember not talking. I mean, I just remember going in there and doing some stuff, but not really talking. I don't remember talking. I thought it was Bananarama, actually, but unless I'm in the Bananarama video as well.
I was kind of like
Twatted about and then left. I didn't really get to chat to any. I mean, I was a big admirer of Terry Hall, obviously. I don't remember talking to anybody, really.
I'm scanning through the video. You've yet to show up. They're kind of like a ska reggae act.
Yeah, they were great.
This song is anyway. Who's Terry Hall, did he say?
Yeah.
Oh, there you are.
What am I doing?
So far, you've just waved at someone. They're doing like a party in their living room, singing, and
that's
everyone's
right,
dancing
yeah.
to the song. Oh, there you are as well. You're dancing. You're doing your old head shaky dance. Christ. And the first thing you do is like you wave across the room like you've just right. arrived at the party.
Yeah.
And I think we're approaching the end of the video now. That might be it. Just two
yeah.
shots.
Yeah.
Are you in the wide? You must be in the wide shot here.
I guess.
I can't
it all seemed
you.
A bit pointless. At the time, no, they were brilliant. I'm trying to think of... Well, he was the lead singer of... Was he the Specials? Yeah, he was, you know, This Town Coming Like a Ghost Town. That
no
was terrible.
Way.
And then he formed the Fun Boy 3 with a couple of the other guys at Specials, I think. And they were just... I can't think of the hits now, but they had some amazing songs.
Well, there's one to look up then. New wave pop band between 1981 and 83. Terry Hall, Neville Staple, and Linville Golding after
yeah.
they left the Specials.
Left the Specials, right, yeah.
Ah, okay, that changes everything. They've got credentials.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, and Richard also, oh no, that was it. The third question we've covered on this podcast. James, there's been lots of Vic and Bob chat regarding your shocking statements on Vic and Bob last week. James asks, I wonder if Alexi and Talal have, thanks for including me, have seen Catterick. I feel like they tried something different and got slapped down for it. So you were kind of, to reiterate last week, you were like, you were asked, what do you think of Vic and Bob? Because they also have Dadaist kind of roots.
Yeah.
There was a connection there. And you brought up how they irked you at the time. It was a poisonous jealousy because they were successful and your career was in decline.
Yeah.
And you also felt like they would do the same joke all the time, every time. But you did really like them when they first started out.
Yeah.
However, I told you that was me growing up and loving them to bits. And you said, don't trust anything I say. I was probably just really jealous. But yes, so James says, you know, they did make a sitcom or kind of, it was like a drama comedy thing called Catterick.
Yeah. I don't know.
You don't know. You don't remember this show.
I remember it. I remember it being on. I didn't watch it or anything. And I've got nothing interesting to say about it.
But this idea, though, that they did try something else.
Yeah.
And no one really bit.
No,
said, that's... keep doing the thing we like you for.
Yeah. Oh, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, you know, I talked about how, yeah, obviously Paul Whitehouse and Bob Mortimer have got this fishing thing, and that's very successful.
Yeah.
I hope me and Nigel did Celebrity Antiques Road Trip, that would somehow lead to me and Nigel doing something together, you know.
Yeah.
Getting a bit of that. But I see now fucking Adrian Edmondson has got a bird watching show with, can't remember who, so Adrian's scooped us. He's found a thing.
Sam and Aid go birding.
Yeah, with Sam West. It was, Prunella Scales and Son. I think it's been very good on Palestine, I think. Although I don't see him doing much lately, but I remember seeing him at things in Trafalgar Square a while back. But yeah, he's got, Adrian's got a bird watching thing. So me and Nigel have got no interest in, you know, but and have no chemistry.
You've got to make one up.
On screen chemistry.
No chemistry.
No on screen chemistry.
The Alexi, Nigel, and Lisa watch The Young Ones, which there are two episodes of on our Patreon. You've got good chemistry there. Nigel. But maybe Lisa is the factor that brings it out of you guys.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
I know she had like the energy and she was physically sat between you and
right.
She had the bit, she had all the memories and the catalyst, the things that made you
right.
Come out of your shells a bit.
Right.
Maybe we need a threesome.
Maybe we need air as well. Right. Then we have to, somebody could suggest. This is to the listeners. So if somebody could suggest something that me and Nigel and maybe Lisa could fake an interest in, like fishing or bird watching.
Send in your suggestions. Email us at alexisalepodcast@gmail.com. Message us on Instagram, alexisalepod, or most favorably, please join the Patreon, patreon.com/alexisalepodcast. And you can message us directly on there as well. Okay, look, we're over halfway, so let's get into what everyone is chomping at the bit for.
Film Club.
This week's Alexi Sales Film Club. Your favorite weekly segment is 1958's Touch of Evil, written and directed by Orson Welles. It is a adaptation of the novel
Badge of Evil.
Badge of Evil, thank you very much. And also starring Charlton Heston, or Charlton Mexican, as I call him, and Orson Welles and Janet Leigh, the wonderful, beautiful, talented tragic role of Janet Lucas. Touch of Evil, 1958. It's okay. Can I give a quick summary of what it's about?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, you've got the Mexican narcotics officer and his newlywed wife, the Vargases, Mr. and Mrs. Vargas, are on their honeymoon crossing the border from Mexico to America when a car bomb goes off, assassinating a... What do you think his job was, this guy? The Lineker,
was
Mr.
he a property
Lineker.
Developer or something? I can't remember now.
A rich man and his young sugar baby get blown up in a car. And so Vargas gets embroiled and tied up into this case when he's on the scene when it happens. And this famous Mexico City detective, Captain Hank Quinlan, shows up on the scene, played by Orson Welles. And he's got this instinct that everyone is just, he's famed for. His gammy leg quivers whenever he has an instinct, a hunch. And he seems to always be right. And this leads them off onto a romp around the Mexico-US border, dealing with gangsters, drug dealers, and prostitutes. And there's themes of corruption in the police, racism, drug use. And in the end, well, that's it, really. I didn't have it written down, this synopsis, as you could probably tell.
No, it was a reasonable summation.
Pretty good, huh?
Yeah, so I was prompted to suggest this by watching that. And there's a second half, which we haven't watched, and exhaustive. I think it's Arena documentary on Orson Welles, which was actually made me like him a lot more, because I always thought he was a kind of difficult character, really. But he seems very self-deprecating. He obviously had a kind of fascinating career in a way, in that he started off really, really a big star when he was quite young, and obviously made Citizen Kane, which is considered one of the 5 or 10 greatest movies of all time by people who pronounce on these things. But then kind of either through self-sabotage or whatever, really, got kind of his career then kind of stalled. He had a project, Chimes at Midnight, which was a film which he kind of shot over like 20 years or stuff, so all the actors like get older and the locations change, and a scene might start off in a kind of hammam in a bath in Morocco and then end in a, then might suddenly be in a kind of catacomb in Turin and then be in a
Tesco in Liverpool,
a bedsit in Cheshire. I think Charlton Heston, so at a low point in his career anyway, Charlton Heston, I think, had this project and insisted that Orson Welles both direct and write it. And it is remarkable for several things. First of all, there is, which was then unheard of, there's a 3-minute tracking shot, a single shot, in which you see the bomb being planted in the boot of this car, then they get in it, and then they drive, across to the Mexican border, and they're stopped. And it's also interwoven with a lot of crowd action, and also with the camera moves around a lot, I guess, on a crane.
Yeah,
so it's on a crane. Very smooth. And you see other bits of dialogue with Charlton Heston and his new wife, Janet Leigh, all in this single shot, and then the car pulls up at the border and this conversation, then they go into it, and then the car go back into the United States, and then the car blows up in a separate shot. But it's the longest tracking shot in the history of film up until that point. And obviously you couldn't fake it. It had to be done. And I know there's a story, I think, that Welles tells, that the border guard kept getting his lines wrong. And if you look, it's actually dawn. You can see the sun coming up when they finally got a shot. He just said to him, say whatever you want, just make sure they go through. Because so I think it took all night, but it's actually dawn when that shot is, but it's an extraordinary. And then there's some other extraordinary shots, just amazing. There's a scene where they're just driving an open top car, and again, it's like a crane shot, but they're just kind of hurtling through these back alleys.
Yeah, and the camera's shaking.
Yeah, but moving just ahead of them, and it's utterly unique. Nothing like, and obviously lots of kind of a kind of heavy stark lighting that Wells was very proud of, and used, and kind of off tilter, off, you know, sort of not, the camera's kind of tilted. There's a lot of that stuff. And then the performance, I mean, his performance as Hank Quinlan, the detective, it's very unflattering. He's fat and wheezy and a drunk. And
yeah,
it's a very compelling, you know, and you, there is a, I mean, I think, I mean, the version that we get to see is not bad, but I think there probably is a more, there's a more interesting film, which the, because the studio butchered, I think, the cut that we get to see if we rent it from a streamer. But it's still a very complex, you know, Hank Quinlan's a very complex character. And of course, there's Marlene Dietrich in a kind of cameo as a kind of brothel owner, who has the final line, you know. And
he was some kind of a man.
He was some kind of a man, yeah.
What does it matter what you say about people?
Yeah, it's just an extraordinary film. I think it was actually filmed in Dublin for Mexico. I think it is Venice Beach.
Oh.
In Los Angeles, I think. That kind of Italianate, weird Italianate architecture. And obviously the border then, I guess, they just sort of walk between, there's just a hut really with some,
yeah, very casual
military piece. They just walk between. There's also one of my favorite kind of subplot. There's an actor called Dennis Weaver in it. And Dennis Weaver was, he was at a TV series, I think, called Gunsmoke, which he played Marshall Dillon, which was a big hit on TV in the 50s.
Well, I'm a Bonanza man myself.
But he also, Dennis Weaver also stars in the first film that Steven Spielberg directed, which is a movie called Duel. In fact, we could also watch that. And I remember we saw, it was made as a telly movie, but it was then, it was so remarkable. And Spielberg was, I don't know if he was even 20 when he directed it. It is based on a Richard Matheson science fiction short story about this man who is menaced for no reason by this kind of truck that just, and Dennis Weaver plays the guy, the salesman, and I remember we didn't know who Spielberg was as anything or anything. I remember we saw it and, well, we'd heard about it or something, went to see it in the cinema. It's a truly remarkable film for
I've heard good things about this Duel film.
Duel, yeah, it's really interesting.
But this Dennis Weaver, he was like the ham of the movie. He was overacting. Really,
Linda said he's that's what Linda
such
said.
Such a weird
character.
He was the night manager of the motel.
Yeah.
I always think that Janet Leigh ends up getting having her own little side adventure in.
Yeah.
She's stuck in this motel on her own in this honeymoon. But this guy seemed clearly is like mentally disturbed or something, but is just so over-egging it.
That's what Linda said. I don't mind his performance, but it is very, very over the top.
It's comical, but when he's doing scenes with Heston, it's very, very, and when he's doing scenes with Janet and they're side by side, it's so evident. Like it's like he's in a different film.
I guess he's been told to do that, but it's stanks and hair. That's always, I still think that to myself, but it stanks and hair.
She stayed here. And over-egging it too were the drug heads. This guy who'd like done a bit of weed, or I guess they said mainlining, but I don't think he was on heroin in that scene. I think it was like Reefer Madness time, wasn't it? And these guys, these potheads were acting insane.
Yeah.
And just vibrating and unable to be still. Which is the opposite of what weed does to you. It makes you very still. But this guy's just jumping like that, which I found hilarious. And just to go back to that opening shot, I just have to note, I have to commend how, even by today's standards, that's that I'm sure, set the bar for tracking shots because it tells so much story, and so much story is told through the movement of the camera.
Yeah, exactly.
And not just by words. And from the very first frame, which is the close-up on the bomb and the guy setting the timer, it's perfection.
Mm.
And the way it weaves and moves so smoothly is really technically impressive, but brings your attention to different elements of the story in perfect timing. And it's just, it is mind-blowing. And the lighting, you mentioned it was the dawn was, I noticed that the dawn, it was sunrise.
Mm.
But I also noticed throughout the film, several shots were shot day for night, they call it. So they obviously shot it during the day and then added a filter to make it look like night, even though you can see like the reflection of the sun on the car bonnet and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I wonder if there was a matter of logistics there as well.
Very much on a shoestring, I think. So
right. And shooting at night is difficult and expensive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can we talk about Charlton's brown face a little bit?
That's
the one kind of thing you have to ignore because it's a questionable choice. And Charlton was famously really right wing dude, wasn't he?
Yeah.
So I found that odd that he's doing this shocking interracial relationship where the male is the foreign guy. That is so rare. Normally, if you have an interracial relationship in film and TV, even till today, it's so rare that the man is the ethnic person. It's always the woman. Yeah.
But here he's the district attorney, isn't he? I think in Mexico City or something.
He's the chairman of the Pan American Narcotics Commission. Job position is.
Right.
And he's an amazing performer in this. But his Spanish is very bad.
I think his Spanish is very bad. Yeah.
You speak better Spanish than him. Your accent is much better.
Verdad.
So what do you think about that? How do you see that as an issue? Does that break the reality of the film for you, seeing Charlton Heston?
It does a little, I think. I mean, you just note it and then move on, I think. But it's obviously, you know, it's of its time, the movie. So, you know, that. That's a whole debate, isn't it? Applying the moral standards of today to things of the past, you know, it also plays into that conversation we had last week about whether you listen to, you know, Wagner or what kind of films, Woody Allen or, you know,
Kanye West,
yeah.
But the fact that he's such a right wing person, Charlton Heston, was famously, you know, he would have been a MAGA today, you know. But here he is portraying a Mexican with a beautiful white American wife, being the hero of a movie.
Yeah. I don't know much about him, whether he became more right wing in later life, or whether he was.
Oh, that's a good point.
I mean, the fact that he was friends with Orson Welles, Welles never got caught up, I don't think, in the House American. I mean, he was never accused of communism or anything, although he would have been working at the time of McCarthy, I guess. As far as I know, he didn't fall foul of McCarthy, but he was, I mean, I would have thought he was politically a progressive, really.
And this would have been his Hollywood lovey darling years, wouldn't it? He would have just been.
Well,
Charlton.
Yeah, he was a big star then, wasn't he? Massive.
I was annoyed at him for leaving his wife alone in that motel long.
Yeah, it's really, it does make you kind of anxious, doesn't it? Because he is so, he drives past her at one point and she's shouting at him from the hotel room and stuff, yeah. It doesn't entirely make sense, things that happen there, but it's maybe in the longer cut, everything is explained.
So you mentioned Orson's directing style, and it is groundbreaking. You know, it's outrageous that he existed at the time he did, when I'm sure if you put other films of the time side by side with this, even films in this later in the 60s and stuff, the creativity of the camera shots, and you'd think it's needless. You know, there's this fight scene he's having with Grandy. When Orson Welles himself, he's about to murder the gang
Mexican leader. Guy, yeah.
Grandy, and Grandy's trying to escape out of a window, and Orson, all he's doing is crossing the room to approach him, and he's going to grab him from the window. Yeah, but they choose this shot, which is slightly at a Dutch angle, like you mentioned before, but also there's this low bit of the roof. There's this bit of the roof that comes down at an angle, and it forces the character to hunch over as he's coming towards the camera. And it just adds, there was no need for that. They could have shot a different part of the room. We could have had him just walking normally. But that little motion that he makes, because he's, like you said, he's so hideous. He's such an unflattering character. These big bags under his eyes. You can almost smell the alcohol coming off. But that choice, just to have him like have to hunch over, which makes him lean towards the camera, makes it so much more menacing.
Yeah.
And shows you this angle of him, and shows you also that, because he's a disabled character.
Yeah.
But in this one scene, he overpowers and kills a man, you know, and it shows you that he is still fearsome and strong and all that, and agile enough to know, you know, dodge these obstacles. And I wrote down here, like, this movie is like a Coen Brothers movie.
Yes.
You know, the dialogue is snappy. The bit players, characters who are in it for like one or two scenes, or even just have a couple of lines, they all have something interesting about them.
Yes.
These fun, quirky characters. Again, there's no need to do that. Any other film would just have, oh, just have Bill come in and say the line.
Yeah.
Orson's like, what can we make different about this guy? What makes him interesting? Even though he's got one or two lines. And that's a very Coen-esque thing. Well, they're Orson-esque, I guess. And some of the dialogue is overlapping even, and there's two different conversations.
A lot of overlapping dialogue, yeah.
And the scene will have two different conversations happening, and you as the viewer have to keep up with both.
Yeah.
In order to keep up with the story, because there's two storylines here that are hurtling towards each other, and
yeah,
you have to stay on top of it, and it just keeps you on your fucking toes.
Yeah,
and I it's just, it's cliche to say, but incredibly ahead of his time, Orson Welles. Yep, and I like that he says, "I don't speak Mexican," to the to the Mexican guy. He's like. So these are flawed, deeply flawed characters.
It's funny, isn't it? Because Orson Welles' career seemed to me to be an object lesson in a way, in how not, I mean, started out magnificently and then kind of petered out into self-parody, I think, towards the...
Yeah.
And it always seemed to me to be an object lesson, really, in how not to be, really, how not to... I don't know. I mean, I say I felt more sympathetic to him watching this Arena documentary about him, but I don't, you know, there's a kind of director, particularly film directors, some who thrive on chaos. I always think Terry Gilliam is the epitome of that, you know, and did often deliberately kind of almost sabotage their own productions. That always seemed to me to be an object lesson in how not to be, really, how to just turn up and do the work. You know what I mean? And yeah. I was always sort of sad about Orson Welles' career in a way that he could have, if he, I don't know.
You get these figures here, these artists where the art seems to just consume them, and themselves as a human matters less, and they destroy their bodies and they destroy their careers and reputations, but their art seems to have so much thought into it. Like I was saying, like every choice in this film, whether it is a light or a camera shot or a line of dialogue, everything seems to be a deliberate decision, a choice, an artistic choice.
Yeah.
And they create these amazing things, and they seem to be, even Terry Gilliam, there's stories about him not being really nice person to be around and stuff, and I don't think he's quite the artist that Orson Welles is. But yeah, it's tragic, isn't it? Especially when it's someone that's created so many things that you love, and then you see them treat themselves, make bad choices in their own lives.
Yeah, and you know, and in the end, if they'd be, I don't know, I mean, it's obviously the studio re-edited The Magnificent Ambersons, which is his follow-up to Citizen Kane. The studio obviously re-edited this as well. So, I mean, I don't know, you know, the job, I always think the job is to get the best, you know, to not get yourself in that situation. I mean, Hollywood in the 1950s was not, you know, which may be so difficult that a genius like him couldn't operate.
So
but
yes.
I kind of think to find yourself in that situation where the studio is re-editing your work is to a degree your fault, I think. I don't know. I'd be interested to hear what the listeners think about this. What do we do? Do we have their reaction like next week or do we? I'd be interested to hear what think about
we
it.
We had Ian just ordered a 4K disc of Touch of Evil restoration cut.
Oh, right. That's dedication.
Omar's watching the restoration cut, was watching it. I had on Instagram someone say, great film. Alexei should take Akim Tamarov's part in the remake. That's the Grandy role. Someone thinks you should play Grandy in the remake of it. Did I get any other messages regarding Touch of Evil? Dr. Nick. Touch of Evil, brilliant. Your future is all used up. I loved that line as well. I wrote that down.
Yeah.
He goes, can you read my future? She goes, you don't have any. Your future is all used up.
Used up.
Despite Chuck Heston's Mexican face and the questionable prosthetics of Wells, this is a work of art. I guess maybe in the HD restorations, you can see the makeup a bit more on Orson Welles' face. But
really?
It's not that
I didn't
terrible.
Know. I thought he was just that fat, but he was plumped out. Was he? I couldn't see the version. I couldn't see that.
I'm not sure which version I saw. On IMDb, it did mention something of it said it's like an uncut version, but I don't know if that's the 1998 restoration. I'm moving away from this message now for a second. On IMDb, it says a new version running 111 minutes has been restored by Universal and debuted at the Telluride Film Festival in 1998. It had been re-edited according to Orson Welles' original vision, outlined in a 58-page memo that the director wrote to Universal studio head Edward Mull. In 1957, after Mull took editing out of Welles' hands, so the original film wasn't like, how they didn't edit Orson Welles' version, they just didn't let him edit it full stop. And they put out their studio version of it. anyway, back to this message. From Dr. Nick. Hi, Dr. Nick. One of those films.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Dr. Nick.
One of those films where
Dr.
every
Nick
shot.
Riviera from The Simpsons. I still do that as well. Sometimes I say when I'm I'm going into Kung Fu and everybody's waiting in the hall outside, and I go, "Hello, everybody." And then because nobody responds, I go, "Hello, Dr. Nick." Dr. Nick Riviera from The Simpsons. And the guy that did the voice, who I can't remember his name now.
Hank Azaria.
Oh. No, not Hank Azaria. It was the one who was shot dead by his girlfriend in a
Phil Hartman.
Motel room. Phil Hartman, was it? Yeah.
He didn't do Dr. Nick, did he?
I think he did.
But also, to correct you, Dr. Nick says, hi, everybody.
Hi everybody, yeah.
No, that's a Hank Azaria voice.
That's all crap.
Phil Hartman did Troy McClure, amongst others.
The president's neck is missing. Movies such as The President's Neck is Missing.
Who is kind of a Charlton Heston parody, Troy
McClure. Yeah.
Every shot counts and stands out, says Dr. Nick. The cinematographer won an Oscar a couple years later for, do you know the film?
No.
Spartacus.
All right.
The sound design in the last 15 minutes, incredible.
Is it John?
Yes, we need to talk about the final scene before we wrap up. We'll get back to that. Great acting all round and almost throws away cameos by Joseph Cotten, Marlene Dietrich. The plot is sort of beside the point. It's more the experience the film gives you. Yeah.
And that's true of all noir, isn't it, really?
Yes.
I mean, is that famous? What's the... Philip Marlowe, the famous one.
Long Kiss Goodnight.
Long Kiss Goodnight, which is written by Raymond Chandler. Even Raymond Chandler said he didn't know what it was about.
Or is it The Big Sleep?
And there's that famous scene which Tarantino stole or referenced where he opens the briefcase and there's just a bright light shines. I mean, it's a brilliant scene, just shines out of it. It's never made clear what it is, the MacGuffin, you know. Anyway, sorry, where were we? Yeah.
He's just disgraced that this film didn't get any Oscar recognition. Now, about the ending. Now, we're coming up to the end. We should be finishing the podcast now. The yes. ending of the film. I had a flashback to The Third Man as well, because Third Man ends on this big Ferris wheel, and Charlton Heston begins this final scene up in the tower of an oil pump.
Right.
And I thought the whole thing was going to take place up there, but he pretty soon climbs down.
Mm.
But Orson Welles likes using tall structures, it seems, at the end of films. I don't know.
Right.
But
Orson Welles didn't direct Third Man, of course. It was directed by Carol Reed.
Oh, okay. Forgive me. He's just in it then.
Yes.
Okay. My mistake.
Again, another fucking black and white masterpiece.
Noir.
And you know, there's
classic.
A cinema in Vienna that chose nothing but The Third Man.
Is it?
Yeah. You can go and see it anytime. We went when we were in Vienna a few years ago. We went and they show it in English and then French and, you know, in different languages. That's all it chose, is The Third Man.
Because the film is set there.
It's set in Vienna, yeah. And then we found ourselves just wandering around Vienna. We found the doorway the first time that the Joseph Cotton character sees Orson Welles. He kind of emerges from a doorway in sort of out of the shadows. And that we found that doorway by just by accident. Of course, the script written by Graham Greene.
Ah.
Also, somebody you could have a long talk about.
Okay, let's just quickly talk about the ending of this film. So
yeah.
Orson Welles detective gets back on the booze after 12 years sobriety. He's getting frustrated that Charlton Heston's character, who hasn't technically got jurisdiction on this crime, is getting involved in the solving of it. And so Orson Welles teams up with the gangster Grandy to fuck Charlton Heston up and frame a guy for the bombings.
Mm-hmm.
However, Charlton Heston does some digging and finds out that Orson Welles has been framing criminals or suspects for years and years, and that's his modus operandi.
Mm.
He hasn't got a hunch, a quivering knee hunch thing at all. He just plants evidence and frames people.
Yeah.
And so he gets Orson Welles' mate to wear a wire and try and get a confession out of Orson Welles. It leads to a bust up by a canal, leaving them both dead, not Charlton, Orson Welles and his mate. And then we find out, we didn't really cover Janet Leigh's storyline, but she's safe now.
Yeah.
But we find out that the guy he was being framed confesses.
Yeah, he did
at
it.
The very
yeah.
end, which right, does yeah, nullify right. the whole story, makes
yeah,
it all.
Yeah, yeah.
That fucked me up. And I went back and watched the beginning scene, the opening yeah. shot, the tracking shot, and it yeah. is Sanchez holding the bomb at the beginning.
All right.
You can see it, it's him. He's even wearing the same outfit.
I didn't know. Yeah.
I was like, what? The bad guy wasn't the bad guy. But he was a vile yeah. character. But yeah, that was messed up.
Yeah, but that's very clever as well, isn't it? Really?
Very clever.
I think we should wrap it up there just because we've got to do a Let's You React, and I'm getting a bit tired. So, but I would be happy to carry on this discussion next week. Of course, if you want to talk about brownface or blackface, there's also a version of Othello with Orson Welles as Othello, I think. I don't think I hallucinated that. And I mean, I think there is. I mean, as well as the terrible Olivier one.
Am I ever going to find in my digging? Yeah, Orson Welles did do Othello. Am I ever going to find footage of you doing a blackface character? Or in some ironic 80s minstrel thing?
Kind of, yes. I'm afraid. I think that the campaign against anti-Semitism and the board of deputies are sitting on this still. There's a bit in Stuff, which is a joke about continuity, as I seem to remember. And there's one very brief scene where I can't remember quite the gag, but there's one brief scene where I am in full, it's kind of top, sparkly top. I am one of the black and white minstrels. So I'm in black, I'm in minstrel face, black face, you know, big white.
Yes.
So there is some footage out there. of me in blackface. But it's not a joke about race, or it's a joke about continuity. But I do feel that when I run for president, when I run for prime minister of Britain or whatever, I feel that that's still me. I dread the day when that still is revealed. So I suppose I'm getting out ahead of it, like Melania Trump.
That's the way to
getting out ahead of that story. So there is that is the I only.
I did not mean to wear the blackface as a racial commentary. It was about continuity.
When you run for premier in of the country, all right?
Yes.
Fuck me, Arena. The Orson Welles story episodes 1 and 2 are on BBC iPlayer as well. I look forward to watching that. Send us your observations and notes and questions about Touch of Evil 1958. I fucking adored it. The ending shocked me. It was beautiful. If I was Charlton Heston's wife, I would never forgive him after that, but she goes home in his arms.
Yeah.
Again, she gets drugged and acts like a maniac. They exaggerate so much what drugs do to you. Big up yourselves. We got to go. Patreon.com/Let's Sell Podcast to see the video edition of our podcast and all else. All right, let's go film Alexi Reacts. Let's go.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Alexi Sell Podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexiselpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.